Now that we're in June, we are awaiting a number of big decisions from the Supreme Court, including on affirmative action and voting rights. But we want to take a look at how we got here with a 6-3 conservative supermajority court that has struck down a number of longtime precedents. Public trust has also fallen. A Gallup poll found the approval rating for the Supreme Court was at 40% in 2021. That's the lowest level on record. CNN's senior Supreme Court analyst Joan Biskupic looks at all of this in her new book, Nine Black Robes, Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. Joan, nice to speak with you again.
Wonderful to be with you, Jane.
You describe a conservative court that is not afraid to strike down major precedents like access to abortion. Just tick through for us some of the major precedents this court has overturned.
You know, it is a court that seems to be in a hurry. And last term is Exhibit A, when they rolled back protections in the church-state area. They enhanced Second Amendment gun rights. And most stunningly, reversed nearly a half century of women's privacy rights in the Dobbs decision that ended Roe v. Wade. And you're right to even point to what's happening now in June as the justices wrap up this current term. Not only have we seen the erosion of precedent in recent terms, we could see it within the next couple of weeks too, Jane.
Well, you do some deep reporting on how this court got this way, and you go behind the scenes with Donald Trump before he was even elected in 2016. He put out a list of conservative judges he wanted on the court to quell concerns from conservatives about what kind of judges he would select. How would you characterize how the Trump administration went about filling these vacancies and the machine behind it all compared to other administrations?
First of all, there was a real consistency, and they weren't going to leave anything to chance. Don McGahn, who became Donald Trump's White House counsel, observed that in the past, folks used to think that it was bad to have a paper trail because senators could pick apart that paper trail. Donald Trump and the men, and they were men, who were really helping him choose judicial candidates, wanted deep paper trails so that there would be no errors. As some of our listeners will remember, in 1990, when George H.W. Bush chose David Souter, he turned out to be in the left side of the bench, and the mantra developed, no more suitors. Well, Donald Trump, working with then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, working with Don McGahn, and working closely with the Federalist Society's Leonard Leo, went for people with deep records. And remember, Jane, he promised that he would appoint only justices who were ready to roll back Roe v. Wade, and all three of his appointees voted to reverse Roe v. Wade last year.
Interesting, your reporting on how the court functions behind the scenes. Justices are loath to appear to be making deals, but is there horse trading, Joan? Are there private pacts being made as they work toward majority decisions?
Most definitely. Well, first of all, with any small group where you have to have 5 votes for a majority, you have to have some compromise, some back and forth. But there have been so many times when I was able to ferret out a switched vote, trades along the margins. What even got me thinking about this book, Jane, was I started to observe a Trump effect where there seemed to be actually more maneuvering, more of an eye toward trying not to appear political. So Chief Justice John Roberts would discourage his colleagues from taking certain cases that might play to the polarization outside the court. And that caused more divisions inside because justices to his right were ready to go pretty strong on so many issues that John Roberts wanted more of a hedge. He was in a position to vote sometimes more to the left to try to tamp down expectations of a purely polarized bench.
Let me ask you more about the Trump effect, because this conservative supermajority court created by Trump has not always sided with Trump, particularly in the high-profile case about the 2020 election and efforts to overturn Trump's loss. What lesson do you take from the times that the court has not sided with Trump?
Well, even before that, you might remember that he had been winning on immigration cases. But by the time we got to the summer of 2020, he lost the case when he had tried to roll back the deferred action for childhood arrivals. So by the time we get to the election, and I have to say, during the primary in 2020, the five conservatives had been siding largely with Republican interests on things like absentee ballots, access to the polls. But when it came right down to whether they were going to intervene at all in Donald Trump's effort to try to challenge the win that Joe Biden had, there were no takers at all. And we also saw it, Jane, in lower courts. He was shut out there.
You described Chief Justice John Roberts as tactical. He seemed to be more in control of the court in the early Trump years, but now in many cases, he's actually a dissenting vote. He seems to be searching for consensus, trying to keep the court from appearing to be political. He's also faced criticism over ethical issues at the court recently. I want to play a clip. Here is John Roberts at an awards dinner in Washington last month.
I want to assure people that I am committed to making certain that we as a court adhere to the highest standards of conduct. We are continuing to look at things we can do to give practical effect to that commitment.
Can you describe how Roberts is handling his role right now and how he'll be remembered in history?
You know, there was once the heyday of John Roberts, and that was before the court's supermajority, when Amy Coney Barrett came on and gave the conservatives on the far right 5 votes. They no longer needed John Roberts, which is why he was an odd man out in the Dobbs ruling. You know, he dissented to the part of the decision that rolled back Roe, and he has not been with them on some of their strongest moves to the right. And the same with ethics, Jane. He has wanted to have some sort of formal ethics policy. Actually, he himself came around to that view, but he can't get a majority for that. And if you're talking about an ethics policy, you can't have a divided vote because it means that some justices will follow it and some justices won't. And I think to go to your bottom line question here about how history will remember him, at this point, we see someone who is still in control on issues like race and religion and government regulation, but on the social policy questions, reproductive rights, he no longer can control how fast the court moves and how far to the right the court moves.
In his effort to search for consensus, you report on how Justice Roberts and liberal Justice Elena Kagan have seemed to have the ability to negotiate with each other. Can you give an example of that?
Yes, I can go all the way back to 2012 during the Obamacare dispute, the very first one. John Roberts at first was ready to strike that down. And then working with Justices Breyer and Elena Kagan, changed his mind and cast the decisive vote to uphold that in 2012. And then in 2019, when Donald Trump had tried to get a citizenship question added to the 2020 census, went about it in a way that, you know, was so obviously political. And initially, John Roberts was going to defer to the administration's efforts there, but again, had second thoughts at the end and switched over and said that the procedures that the Trump administration had used were flawed. And in both those instances, Elena Kagan played a role. And Elena Kagan and John Roberts both come from administration backgrounds. They had also, you know, similar academic records, and I think they were good partners to try to find consensus at the middle of the court. But Jane, there is no middle of the court for them to navigate anymore with this 6-3 lopsidedness, because if someone like Justice Kagan or her fellow liberals can persuade John Roberts to come to their side, that only gives them 4 votes. They still need a 5th.
We mentioned the very poor public perceptions of the court right now. What does your reporting suggest what the justices think about how they're viewed?
That's a great question, and it differs. Some of the justices are quite concerned. And historically, the court has not been too far out ahead or behind where the American public has been. And I think John Roberts definitely understands that. And I think he's one person who is concerned about the court's reputation. But what he will say publicly He says our critics are complaining because they don't like our rulings. They're not really questioning our stature. But I don't know if he actually believes that, because I don't think it's true. I think the polls show so many people having a changed opinion of the court these days. It's not just a lot of liberals and progressives. It's a greater swath of people questioning whether the court is operating in a non-political way.
And so as we await some of these big decisions, possibly overturning more precedents, what do you see as the future of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think a part of me, Jane, believes that the court does eventually steady itself, because that has been the American history. But the new conservatives are so young, they're only in their 50s, and so many legal and political science professors have sort of gamed this out for the future and suggested that we will have a court like this one for at least the next 50 years. So given how polarized America is and what might be in our future for presidents and strategic retirements, maybe we will have for a few more decades a court that is this lopsided.
Joan Biskupic is author of the new book, Nine Black Robes, Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. She's CNN's senior Supreme Court analyst. Joan, thank you as always.
Thank you, Jane.